Good morning. Yesterday, if you were here, in 55 minutes, all speakers spoke for about 3 to 4 minutes each. Today, they actually get to talk for a little bit longer throughout the day on various subjects. McGill's Evolution Education Research Center was founded to sort of tackle science education's biggest problem, evolution education. It's a big problem worldwide in a variety of different ways. And a lot has been researched on the Christian view of evolution and evolution education. But there's really a dearth of information concerning the Islamic view on evolution and evolution education. So we've gathered a bunch of panelists here today. We've been concluding a 3-year, $250,000 study on the subject. And a lot of people have a lot to say today. I'm merely moderating, so I get to sit down and enjoy it with you. This is the list of people you'll be hearing from today. Quite an impressive group of people from around the world, various universities and institutions. I'm not even going to give you time to read that. I'm going to click to the next click real quick here so we can get started. It's a little bit late already. And our first is Tanner. Tanner, where are you? Come on down.
Is this working? Okay. Somehow I suspect the reason I'm going first is that I get to work out the kinks in the technology. Yeah.
Yes.
So check and see if this works. Okay. So things seem to be working fine. And if I need a pointer, there's that. Okay. Probably won't need a pointer. Okay. So I'll get started with the... Now, this is a picture of a book that you're going to be seeing fairly often today if you stay around for the other talks as well. This is a monstrosity of a book that was sent to... Typically science departments, biology departments especially, throughout North America and Europe a couple of years ago from Harun Yahya. This is an Islamic creationist work. It's of Turkish origin, but has become lately very popular internationally. And it's a very basic creationist work with not much substance to it. Sees Darwinism as a materialist conspiracy. But I want to sort of start by putting this in a little bit of a context of other types of popular pseudosciences in the Islamic world. And, for example, the notion that if you look at the Islamic scriptures, particularly the Quran, the notion that you can find modern science and technology anticipated in there, this is also a very common pseudoscientific idea in the Islamic world. For example, there are many Quranic verses that talk about 7 layers of skies, or the 7 heavens over there. And many Muslim commentators, for example, Haluk Nurbaki in Turkey, will talk about trying to interpret this in terms of modern astrophysics. But the thing is, if you know anything about modern astrophysics, you also know that there is nothing like a layer structure of skies that we can, in our modern understanding of the universe. But in contrast, if you look at a rather ancient conception of the universe, the Ptolemaic model, you have the 7 planetary spheres. So very often what's happening is that people will look at kind of fossils of ancient cosmological ideas in the Quran and try and interpret these in modern terms. And so there was a lot of pseudoscience going on in the Islamic world right now. It's not just limited to creationism. And there are many motivations behind this. The idea is that very often science and technology are very modern and prestigious ways of legitimating traditional beliefs. And so if you can say that from 1400 years ago the Quran miraculously anticipated modern science, that's kind of a proof of a divine source of the Quran for many people. It's kind of equivalent, I tend to think of, like the way many conservative Christians will look at claims of biblical prophecy as a way of validating, say, the Bible as the Word of God. And especially in an age of technology where modern media and the internet is very effective, these things spread like wildfire all over the Islamic world. Now, given that there's a lot of pseudoscience in the Islamic world, and also, well, let's admit it, the Islamic world is not very good at natural science. I'm in physics, and if, say, for example, every Muslim physicist were to vanish from the face of the earth tomorrow, the community of physicists would actually barely notice. The productivity of Muslim physicists is extremely low. While, if you want, as a matter of contrast, if, say, Israeli physicists were to vanish from the face of the planet tomorrow, physics as a community would notice very much. Now, given this sort of rather disastrous state of science in Islamic lands and the rather popularity of very pseudoscientific notions of what science is in Islamic lands, Very often the question I get is, well, why is this happening? Particularly because if you were to go back, say, to the 11th century, 12th century, and you were to look around where is the best science in the world, you would probably go around, you would probably pick up Muslim lands. You would certainly not pick out the land of the barbarians and dark ages in Western Europe. And so the question very often is, what happened so that Muslim science really went into this decline? But in a way, this is almost the wrong question, because Muslim science did not greatly decline on its own terms. It was more of a matter of Europe relatively advancing very, very fast, surging away. And particularly what's important over here, modern science is a very new way and different way of understanding the world. While if you look at medieval Muslim science, this is very much embedded in religious and occult ways of thinking, and it's very different from modern science. So if you really want to have an idea of how Muslim science got to be in the dire circumstance it is right now, we should be looking at more recent history rather than medieval history. Because the past few centuries in Islamic lands, it really has been dominated by the need to catch up to the Western world. And the equation that people followed was fairly clear early on. The West has this big technological advantage, which directly translates into military and commercial power. And therefore, Muslims, say, in the 1700s and so forth, were pretty clear that they needed to bring in this new modern form of knowledge, science. But also, early on, one of the themes that was fairly clear in what was happening among Muslim intellectuals talking about how they catch up to the West is that they needed to do this, they thought, and be very clear that they were defending Islam every step of the way as well. A very common theme has been the notion that Muslims need to borrow the technology of the West, but also guard against foreign cultural influences while doing so. And this is still, in Islamic debates over science and religion, this is still a fairly major theme. And so, for example, in the late 19th century, when, for example, in the Ottoman Empire, both Turks and Arabs were the more educated elite classes were very interested in the scientific knowledge coming in from Europe, particularly at a kind of a popular level. But with that, together with the popular science literature, the 19th century materialism as it was going on in Europe, such literature was also partially translated. And this immediately provoked a reaction. The more materialist aspects of science were seen as undesirable. And Muslims reacted particularly badly to this, unlike the European context, where there was a lot of controversy, but at least the materialism there was seen more of an internal heresy, as it were. It was something that developed naturally out of European intellectual debates. For Muslims, everything was coming in as an import, as a sort of a foreign imposition. It made it more difficult. And down into the 20th century, Muslim responses to science and religion issues has been very much conditioned by the awareness of Muslim intellectuals of what's happening, particularly in Europe. And Europe, because it has continued on a secularizing trajectory, very often Muslim intellectuals will see Europe as an example to avoid, a kind of a disaster for religion. So even today, if you look at very contemporary debates about things like evolution in places like Turkey, you'll see that worries about materialism regularly come to the forefront. The quotation I put up over here, the picture is of one Mustafa Akyol. He's a political scientist and journalist in Turkey, and he's very much a liberal Muslim, politically speaking. And he's also the leading proponent of intelligent design in Turkey right now. And the quotation says that intelligent design is indeed a wedge that can split the foundations of scientific materialism. For the first time, the West appears to be the antidote to and not the source of the materialist plague. And in a way, it's a sort of curious that this notion of the materialist plague appears so often in Muslim writings, because there's not an awful lot of materialists to speak of in the Islamic world. It's more of a symbolic enemy. And if materialism is seen to be so much of an issue to worry about, naturally this calls for a conservative Muslim response. And the reasons are really that technology in particular is very attractive to modern religious people. And this is something I can probably safely say for almost all Muslims. They tend to be very pro-technology. And modern technology is linked to science. And therefore, if you're a religious intellectual, you really don't have much of an option of ignoring science. It calls for some sort of response. There's a need to either appropriate science for more traditional ends, or even sometimes the notion is that science should be corrected if it happens to disagree with traditional beliefs and revealed truths. Now, this is particularly comes to the forefront when you're looking at the Muslim response to Darwin. The early response in the 19th century to Darwin and evolution, as I mentioned before, it came to at least Turks and Arabs in the Ottoman Empire. The debate came in the context of arguments over materialism, arguments over westernization. So it was rather different than, say, the biological debate. Nobody really much cared about questions about, say, biology, fossil records, or things like that. And especially by the more conservative Muslims and religious scholars, what happened was that Darwinian ideas were either ignored or really denounced as an offense to religion. Darwin found a positive acceptance among maybe radical secularizers, but this was really a tiny segment of the population, not necessarily a huge amount of influence. Even Muslim modernists tended to reject evolution. But once we come into the 20th century, evolution does start appearing in things like education in certain Muslim lands, particularly those who try to secularize. And the most important example over here has to be Turkey, because Turkey tried to conduct the most radical experiment in the Muslim world in secularization. In the 1920s and 30s, the leader of Turkey, Atatürk, went around and adopted Western dress and really tried to convert the country from a sort of a pious Muslim population into something like a European state. And as part of that, Darwinian evolution actually started to appear in education. And interestingly enough, evolution actually appearing in early Turkish education does not seem to have provoked much of a creationist reaction. And partially, I think the reason for this is that evolution was only a very minor offense to religion among much deeper offenses to the traditional understanding of religion that were going on at the time. Nonetheless, there was a lot of underground creationism in Turkey up to about the 1970s, in the sense that up to about the 1970s in Turkey, you really didn't see much explicit creationism in the public realm, in, say, the popular press and things like that. However, there was a lot of creationist sentiment underground, and the population probably largely passively resisted evolutionary ideas like a lot of secular ideas. But in the 1970s, you start hearing a little bit, especially follow the popular media, about creationism. And it really shows up as a kind of a minor culture war theme. For example, one of the Islamist parties in the 1970s brought this up in parliament, made a minor media splash about it, and it was kind of like a safe way to oppose official secularism without really challenging the military or anything like that. And at the same time, there were a lot of grassroots modernist religious movements who were actually very deeply involved with pushing creationism there. And its particularly significant movement in Turkey about this is what's called the Nur movement. And it was founded and inspired by Said Nursi, which in Turkey probably has to be the most important religious figure in the 20th century. Actually, his influence goes beyond Turkey as well, particularly as a model for modernizing religious movements that also have a very pseudoscientific approach to science and religion issues. But really the breakthrough that creationism made in Turkey came in the 1980s after a conservative military dictatorship in the early 80s. In the 1980s, the civilian government that followed it, the Ministry of Education was controlled by the equivalent, Turkish equivalent of the religious right, and creationism first started to appear in secondary education. There were official translations of Turkish made from Institute for Creation Research material from the United States. This was distributed for free to schools and to teachers and things like that. And even today, it's pretty easy to find creationist paragraphs in Turkish textbooks. But there's more. Even beyond official creationism, in 1997, the name Hari Yahya burst on the scene in Turkey, really took the Turkish media by storm, and it really was a kind of a massive production of literature on many Islamist and conservative Muslim themes, but the centerpiece of Hari Yahya literature has always been creationism. Maybe easily half of what he puts out has a creationist theme. And it's very sort of strange and opportunistic kind of literature. For example, very early on in 1997, 1998, Hari Yahya also put out, say, Holocaust denial literature. But then it became way too embarrassing for them, and now they don't admit that this ever exists. Now they have literature out that says that, yeah, the Holocaust happened, but actually it was because of Darwinism. And so, which of course is the root of all evil because it's materialism, and they even have books that blame things like terrorism and 9/11, things like that, on Darwinian evolution. Now, I want to point out over here that creationists in Turkey are not a movement defending a traditional version of faith. They are very modern Muslims. The Nur movement in particular is famous among social scientists for their very non-traditional religious authority structure, their modern orientation, their pro-capitalist, pro-technology attitudes, really. Adnan Oktar, who is the figurehead of Turkish creationism right now, if you look at him, he projects a very modern image. He's not dressed in, say, traditional Islamic clothes or anything like that. And the image that Adnan Oktar and his followers try to project is people who have mastered the modern world, people who are at home in technology and the financial, globalized financial world as it is today. And they've mastered modernity, they've remained devout, and they can challenge the materialists the way they present themselves, even in the scientific arena. They're not traditionalists, in other words. And but on the other hand, there's a large constituency which goes beyond the immediate Adnan Oktar movement that opposes evolution. Now, there are, of course, more sophisticated forms of creationism you can find among Muslim intellectuals. Adnan Oktar's creationism is a very sort of simplistic kind of creationism. So this Yahya-style creationism, even that receives a degree of support from devout intellectuals, mainly because they see it as a good way of doing materialist bashing. But there are also more sophisticated opposition to Darwinian evolution attracts devout intellectuals. For example, the intelligent design movement, who has lately been so much in the news in North America, it actually has found some support in Turkey as well. Intelligent design literature has been translated, and they even have things like in 2007, an intelligent design movement was held in Istanbul, sponsored by the city government, who, like most government posts in Turkey, is held by an Islamist party. If you look at, say, academic manifestations of creationism, that's not difficult to find. Indeed, you don't even have to confine yourself to academics in operating in the Muslim world. For example, if you go and look around Muslim literature in any large bookstore in North America, you're likely to run into books by Sayyid Hussein Nasir, who originates from Iran but has been a very well-respected academic in Islamic studies in the United States for a long time. And Osman Bakar, who's originally from Malaysia, but also currently based in the United States, they really are creationists. They're much more sophisticated creationists than Hari Yahya, but they really emphasize themes like they argue evolution cannot create information. They're not too much against the idea of common descent, but they really argue that the Darwinian idea of evolution goes against the top-down, spirit-first view of reality that every true spirituality has to endorse. And indeed, if you broaden your scope, it's easy to find lots of creationist academics in the Islamic world, including particularly applied scientists. You ask around engineers and medical doctors, there's lots and lots of creationism. And indeed, if you go to places like Turkey, it's not too difficult to find creationists who teach biology as biology professors in biology departments. So there's a lot of this going on. Now, of course, I don't want to leave you with the impression that Muslims are kind of monolithically creationist over here. There are lots of options, different ways that Muslim intellectuals respond to evolution. And some of these responses are what we might consider more moderate responses, who try to accommodate some degree of evolution with traditional belief. And typically what people who try to find a middle path will do, they will quote Quranic verses like these and try and say that, hey, maybe you can interpret the Quran in such a way as to allow a degree of evolution. And particularly the notion of guided evolution is very important here. Many Muslims, in fact, will accept a limited version of evolution. It's limited in the sense that they will generally say that, okay, the idea of common descent is typically okay, but you will have a lot more resistance where the idea of human resistance is concerned. And most Muslims who say that they accept evolution, in my experience, tend to think of evolution as a guided, non-Darwinian kind of process, because again, there's this basic intuition that creativity really cannot reside in the material world. So this is kind of attractive as a middle path, but I also have to point out that in religious circles, even this kind of accommodation tends to be controversial. So it's not, generally I would say that Muslims, when they look at Darwin, they may be okay with some degree of evolution, but Darwin often is persona non grata. Now, Darwinian evolution itself, as biologists understand it, there's a certain constituency for this as well in Islamic lands, but it has practically no popular base beyond really academic westernized circles. And it's increasingly this is something that's associated with a discredited secularist elite. It's sort of tarred with a brush of political despotism and cultural inauthenticity. And indeed, to secularists, you will find lots of secularists who might support Darwin, but it's not necessarily because they care about biology per se. Again, it's sort of a symbolic issue in culture wars. Now, I'll also put in a slide because it's very recent just this month that you had censorship of a popular science magazine in Turkey, Bilim ve Teknik, Science and Technology. On here you see the original planned cover about the 200th anniversary of the birth of Darwin, and actually, officially, there was some intervention in this, and they had to, at the last moment, cancel that and replace the issue with a different one on global warming instead. So it can be very controversial, and of course this ignited another round of the creation evolution wars in the popular press. So one impression I want to present to begin with is that if you want an example of a really successful form of creationism, you shouldn't be looking at examples like, say, American creationism. There's a lot of creationism in the United States, but it's not really successful so much. But in the Turkish version of creationism in particular, we have an example of very successful creationism. Now, of course, most Turkish scientists, like the Turkish Academy of Sciences, oppose creationism, but at a popular level, this has been very ineffectual. And Muslim creationism has enjoyed official support in Turkey, has penetrated deeply into evolution, and this is important. The appeal of creationism in Turkey goes beyond what you might think of a rather insular fundamentalist subculture. It's actually relatively mainstream. Now, again, I don't want to create the impression that all Muslims are creationists, not at all. And indeed, there are more liberal options that Muslims will go for as well. And at this point, when somebody starts thinking about, well, what can we do to get Muslims to warm up to the idea of evolution better, probably the first thing you're going to think of is, let's try and get something that has worked reasonably well in the Western world. In other words, promote more liberal theological options where you kind of separate the domains of science and religion and say, well, to each their own, they're not going to conflict. For example, many liberal Christians will say that, hey, well, supernatural ideas kind of retreat to a metaphysical domain. Science deals with the mere details of how nature operates and has its degree of independence, and they don't have to clash. Now, ideas like this, they exist in the Islamic world as well. But they're much rarer. Even people who are politically very liberal will very often tend to try and at some level subordinate science to revelation and moral concerns. There are exceptions, particularly one name that people in the audience might have heard before might have been people like Abdulkarim Suresh in Iran. But precisely because of such liberal views, such scholars tend not to be very welcome at home. So Suresh, for example, was essentially exiled to the West because of his liberal attitudes. So there is this whole creation evolution debate in the Islamic world takes place against a backdrop of pretty strong doctrinal conservatism. Liberal Muslim views are fairly weak in comparison to their Christian counterparts. The idea of reinterpreting scripture, to a certain degree trying to see religion as a human phenomenon, this attracts a lot of opposition. And even people who at many levels are Democrats and modern people, they actually can still be doctrinally very conservative at a cultural level. So the whole discourse of rejecting materialism to try and guard against materialist influences, that really conditions the whole debate, both at the popular level and indeed among intellectuals as well. So I want to close by a couple of thoughts on what are the prospects for this notion of having separate spheres for science and religion in an Islamic context. Now, in the West, the notion that religion and science have their own thing has actually been a reasonably successful idea. in that, yes, you can still find plenty of intellectual friction between science and religion in certain domains, but as a way of separating the institutions of science and religion and having them not step on each other's toes very often, it's a reasonably decent way that has worked to accommodate things. Now, it's very questionable whether this is going to be a development in the Islamic world or not. It's a definite possibility, particularly because right now the Islamic world is in a process of experimentation and change. But also precisely because there's a lot of religious experimentation going on, this means it becomes very difficult to predict the future of something like the creation-evolution wars in the Islamic world. And a lot of this is going to turn on the issue of how much of a practical day-to-day problem is going to be scientific backwardness. Particularly because, actually, in Islamic lands, applied science is not really in quite the dire state as natural science is. So it's easier for people to accept the kind of science that is applied and has pragmatic consequences, but when something like evolution comes out, it's really a conceptual framework that helps us understand the world, and it's much more difficult to point to immediate technological applications, so that has an important effect on the debate as well. So I'll kind of leave it at there, and I'll give a plug for my book. I sort of feel obligated to do that, though it never works. And thanks for listening, and I hope you'll be asking questions later. And I hope I was on time.
5 minutes of questions right now.
Right.
Please make them questions and not statements. Thank you.
Somebody asked me a question. Come on. Go ahead.
Can you explain how materialism isn't accepted in Islam? Like an example of how materialism is?
The question is, she'd like me to present an example of how materialism is not accepted in Islam. There are many levels in which I can try and approach that question. One is fairly basically, if you conceive of materialism as the idea that really, everything we see around us are realized by physical material processes, and there is no such thing as a freestanding world of spirits or gods and demons and things like that. Well, fairly obviously, not just conservative Islam, but just about anybody who's inclined towards a traditionally theistic view of the world is going to find this unacceptable. On the other hand, there's also other levels of responses to materialism in the sense that it's often conflated with the notion of a kind of a crude materialism where people would care only about material things, so be focused on making money all the time. So often those two are thrown together and denounced together. So there are really many levels of ways that Muslims actually interpret materialism to begin with. Any other questions? Go ahead.
Opposition to materialism is very common.
Oh yeah.
In this society, in Western society, it's very common.
Yeah.
In fact, when Darwin published his book,
Karl
Marx was very happy to see that book and read that book, and he wrote to Darwin that the second volume of Das Kapital he wanted to dedicate to Darwin,
which didn't work out.
Please spare me. Do not do this.
Right. Yes.
This is common. Even today, the materialist philosophy, although it is a successful scientific philosophy, but there is a lot of opposition.
Right.
Not limited to Islamic society.
Yeah, that's right. That's another actually example I can give. Materialism has also often been present lately in Islamic societies at the level often of Marxism. So if you were talking about maybe the 1970s or something like that, people who denounced materialism in the 1970s would probably be able to point to Marxist political currents, which were never really very strong, but they at least existed. But one of the curious things right now is actually there's a lot of denouncing materialism going on, but Marxists have long vanished in places like Turkey. A lot of them actually have converted to Islamist political movements, curiously enough. Go ahead.
But isn't that because the post-war political wave right throughout the Middle East and Turkey was secularist, materialist, and they failed to deliver the goods?
There's a lot of that to it, but it's a little bit more complicated than that. For example, even the most radical secularizers, if you look at a Turkish example, you will very rarely find Turks, even secularist Turks, positioning themselves as materialists. In fact, an important part of Turkish secularist discourse has been to try and deny that their secularism has anything to do with lack of religion, materialism, and so forth. So, yeah, it's more of a matter of sort of labeling and accusing and defending the type of usual political debate rather than what you might consider a kind of an academic debate over the merits or problems of materialism and so forth. Go ahead.
You're saying that applied technology is certainly makes an impression in the Islamic world. Are there any perhaps remote effects of things like stem cell research?
Yeah, indeed. If you stay around, it will be mentioned in some of the other talks as well today. For example, Iran is fairly positive towards stem cell research, and they do some decent work. Again, you find that from the Islamic world, occasionally I will run into some decent work being done in applied physics. Turkish engineers actually do a very good job, particularly in civil engineering. They get lots of international contracts all over the world and things like that. In applied science, generally Muslim countries are not in quite as bad a situation as in basic science.
Ideas based on modern ideas about biology become practically important.
That has to be a big part of the argument, I think, if evolution is going to be seen more positively in the Islamic world. The argument has to be made that this is a concept that's has a role in areas like medicine in particular. But it's not necessarily an easy argument to make, especially at the popular level. Okay, I'm told to shut up.
We will take more questions at the end of today from all our panelists. We'll have more time.